Jesus once said the words on the screen, "If anyone loves me, he will keep my word, and my Father will love him, and we will come to him and make our home with him." Those words are true of you if you are a Christian. And if you're not yet a Christian, they would be true of you if you were to become a Christian. Either way, how do those words make you feel? Perhaps we're casual about those words. Perhaps we think, well, of course God loves me. And of course he's present with me. We're casual. Or perhaps we're uncomfortable about those words. Perhaps we think, I don't really like the idea of God being right there with me every moment of the day, watching me at school and at work, when I'm with my girlfriend, when I'm filling in my expenses claim. We're uncomfortable. We're going to see in the book of Exodus tonight and next week that we must not be casual. Our sin means that it's amazing that God loves us and absolutely mind-boggling that he makes his home with us. We must not be casual, but we need not be uncomfortable. Jesus mediates for his people with God and deals with the sin that estranges us from him. So when God comes and makes his home with us, it's not like a grumpy headmaster moving into the spare room. It's like having an honoured house guest who loves us and is glad to be there. And if we're trying to trust and obey Jesus, however imperfectly, then we will find his words profoundly comforting and encouraging, an astonishing honour. "If anyone loves me, he will keep my word, and my Father will love him, and we will come to him and make our home with him." Let's remind ourselves of where we've got to in the book of Exodus so far. In chapter 3, verse 14, God says to Moses that he is called I Am Who I Am. And that's where the name Yahweh comes from, God's personal name that's written in our Bibles in those little funny little capital letters. He's saying, if you want to know who I am, watch what I do and listen to what I say over the 40 chapters of the book of Exodus. And so first, in chapters 1 to 18, Yahweh reveals himself as the God who delivers. The PowerPoint's not quite as clear as it might have been for technical reasons. But the nation of Israel, stuck in slavery in Egypt at the start of Exodus, and through amazing acts of judgment on their slave masters, the 10 plagues and the parting of the Red Sea and all that, God delivers his people from that slavery. And that physical deliverance points us to the even more important spiritual deliverance that Jesus has won for his people. Jesus says in John chapter 8, everyone who commits sin is a slave to sin. But at the cross, Jesus faced judgment for that sin so that if we trust in him, we can be delivered from that slavery. Jesus said, if the Son sets you free, you'll be free indeed. Jesus delivers Christians from slavery to sin. Israel discovered that true freedom didn't mean freedom to do whatever they wanted. They needed help to live in a way that was good for them and that was pleasing to God. And so second, in chapters 19 to 24, Yahweh revealed himself as the God who demands. He gave them loving rules for how to live. We looked at the Ten Commandments last week, and there's several more chapters of demands which we're not going to look at. They didn't earn their freedom by their obedience. Deliverance came before demand, but having been set free, they were to live for Yahweh. And those Old Testament rules point us to the fact that God still makes loving demands on us as Christians today. We're not just free to do whatever we want. God sets us free from slavery to sin in order that we might live in a way that's good for us and pleasing to him. Jesus said, if anyone loves me, he will keep my word. Deliverance comes before demand, but nonetheless, Jesus demands that Christians keep his word. And now we're on to the last section of the book of Exodus. Chapters 25 to 40 show us that the point of God setting Israel free from Egypt and giving them laws to obey was that he wanted genuine relationship with them. He wanted to be the God who dwells with his people. The last section of the book is about the tabernacle, which was a forerunner of the temple except a bit more mobile. Israel are out of Egypt, they're not yet into the promised land, they're wandering around in the desert, and so instead of a more permanent stone temple that they'd have later, they were to make this big tent called the tabernacle, which they could take with them on their wanderings. And like the temple after it, the tabernacle represented God's dwelling. It would sit in the middle of the Israelites' camp and remind them that Yahweh was a God who dwells with his people. Hundreds of years later, John described Jesus' coming to earth like this. He said, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And the word dwelt is really the word tabernacled, if that were a word, which it's not. And having dwelt among humanity during his life on earth, Jesus now dwells in Christians by his Spirit. Jesus came to earth to die, to deliver us from slavery to sin, to show us and to tell us how to keep his word, and to dwell with us now and for eternity. Jesus said, if anyone loves me, he will keep my word, and my Father will love him, and we will come to him, and we will make our home with him. And this last section in Exodus is shaped like a disgusting sandwich. In chapters 25 to 31, you have incredibly detailed plans for how Israel is to construct their tabernacle. God gives them blueprints for the dwelling. And in chapters 35 to 40, you get the construction of the dwelling. And bits are word for word the same. What they've been instructed, they now carry out. God has plans to dwell with his people, and those plans will be carried out. But in case we feel casual about that fact, we need to see that the filling of this sandwich is very disgusting. There is a problem with dwelling. There is a problem with dwelling. For a holy God to dwell with sinful people is not straightforward. And chapters 32 to 34 show us what this problem is. It is sin. And here it is, the sin of worshipping through a misrepresentation of God. And these chapters give us the beginning of a solution. Moses works as a mediator between the people and God. And he points us to Jesus, our perfect mediator, whose mediation means that Christians don't need to feel uncomfortable about the idea of God dwelling with us. Next week we'll focus on the solution, having reminded ourselves of the problem. This week, I'm afraid, we're going to focus mostly on the problem, with just hints of the solution towards the end. So first of all, the problem is worship through misrepresentation. The fundamental problem is sin. And here and often, that sin is expressed in worshipping through a misrepresentation of God. It's a bit difficult to keep track of where Moses is when in these chapters, because as David said last week, he's up and down the mountain like a yo-yo. He's really getting through the pairs of walking boots at a tremendous rate. It seems from chapter 24 that he's probably come down the mountain and told the people the Ten Commandments. He hasn't yet brought down the tablets that they're written on, but they know what they are, and he's now popped back up the mountain to hear the plans for the tabernacle. I think that's probably right. At any rate, at the start of chapter 32, he is at the top of the mountain, hearing from God about his plans to dwell with his people. And at the very time that that's happening at the top of the mountain, this is what's happening at the bottom of the mountain. Exodus chapter 32, verse 1, page 86, if you shut your Bibles. Verse 1 says this. When the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people gathered themselves together to Aaron and said to him, up, make us gods who shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what's become of him. So Aaron said to them, take off the rings of gold that are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me. So all the people took off the rings of gold that were in their ears and brought them to Aaron, and he received the gold from their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool and made a golden calf. And they said, these are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. When Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it, and Aaron made proclamation and said, tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord. And they rose up early the next day and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. And the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Israel can't see Yahweh. And now they can't see Moses either. And they can't stand to have a God that they can't see. So they make something that they can see. So Aaron takes their jewellery and he moulds it and he fashions it, and he must have done all right at GCSE art because he produces this quite respectable looking bull figure. It's not a sweet calf, it's a strong bull. They've got something they can see. Where are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt? Well, right there. There he is, at last. Aaron doesn't think, I don't know quite what the Israelites think they're doing, but Aaron doesn't think that he's making an alternative god. He's just trying to help the people to visualize the true God. So verse 5, he built an altar before the statue and said, tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord, to Yahweh. Aaron would flatly deny that he was breaking the first commandment, which says, you shall have no other gods before me. He does not think that this is another god. If pushed, he might admit that he was just slightly breaking the second commandment. You shall not make for yourself a carved image. You shall not bow down to them or serve them. I mean, actually, he's totally breaking the second commandment, isn't he? But it's what the people want. And you can imagine how he'd justify it to himself. Every other religion around us has images of their god. We need to stay culturally relevant. And we live in a very visual culture. These people are used to having something to look at. And many people in Israel can't read all that well. They're visual learners. And we can't expect them to relate to God solely through his words. And at the end of the day, they find it helpful. And who's to argue with their experience? Well, God, actually. Verse 7, the Lord said to Moses, go down, for your people whom you brought up out of the land of Egypt, your people whom you brought up, he's disowning them, have corrupted themselves. They've turned aside quickly out of the way that I commanded them. They've made for themselves a golden calf and have worshipped it and sacrificed to it and said, these are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. However helpful Aaron might think that he's being, and whatever the people think they're doing as they bring their offerings to it, God says that their worship through this visual representation is corruption. Because you cannot represent the true God visually. You can only ever misrepresent him. Yahweh is complex. He's a sovereign, holy, caring, faithful, speaking God. He's all of those things and more, and no image can possibly represent all of those characteristics and more. A bull may represent a fraction of his power, perhaps. But a bull misleads about God's love, for example. Any image will hide as much as it reveals about God. Nothing in the world can ever truly represent the God who made the world. An image can never adequately represent God. It can only ever misrepresent him. And so the true God is fundamentally opposed to our attempts to approach him through created means like that. Let's see what happens as Moses and his assistant Joshua re-enter the camp. Verse 15, then Moses turned and went down the mountain with the two tablets of the testimony, his hand tablets were written on both sides. On the front and on the back they were written. The tablets were the work of God, and the writing was the writing of God engraved on the tablets. When Joshua heard the noise of the people as they shouted, he said to Moses, there's the noise of war in the camp. But he said, it's not the sound of shouting for victory or the sound of the cry of defeat, but the sound of singing that I hear. And as soon as he came near the camp and saw the calf and the dancing, Moses' anger burned hot. And he threw the tablets out of his hands and broke them at the foot of the mountain. He took the calf that they had made and burned it with fire and ground it to powder and scattered it on the water and made the people of Israel drink it. Moses' anger reflects God's anger. Both are said to burn with anger. He breaks the tablets that have the commandments written on them as an illustration of the breakdown in the relationship between Yahweh and his people that this sin has caused, this worship through misrepresentation. I actually slightly changed my mind on this issue at about 7:30 last night, which is, as you can imagine, is not a great time to realise that you've never really understood the passage you're preaching the following day, but there it is. I now don't think that the second commandment is a blanket ban on visual representations of God. So I've always thought that it was, and I've never known quite what to do about all the Christian art and the children's picture Bibles and so on. I do think there are dangers to those things because they are fundamentally misrepresentations of God, but I don't actually now think that the second commandment is a blanket ban on those things, and I don't think that making an image of Yahweh is the sin, that the Israelites are committing in chapter 32. The second commandment is a ban on worshipping God through images, actually images whether of God or anything else. What the Israelites are doing wrong is worshipping God, worshipping Yahweh by means of this bull. And it still happens today. So a while back I watched a documentary about Christian pilgrimages. The presenter was a sympathetic atheist and he visited Aylesford Priory near Maidstone. He had the great privilege, if that's the right word, of being shown the skull of the 13th century Saint Simon Stock, which the monks of the priory keep in a little box, and which still today people come from a long way away to pray in the presence of. And the presenter said, so have I got this right? People pray to the skull, and the skull answers their prayers. And the monk who was showing him the skull said, no, and the skull has no magical powers. It's just a help for them as they pray to God. And the presenter, rather insightfully, said, but if people come all this way to pray in the presence of this skull, don't you think that some of them are thinking that it has magical powers? And the monk said, oh, well, there's nothing we can do about that, is there? That kind of misunderstanding, that's not our fault. That is just what Aaron would have said. And it made me angry. Of course there's something they can do to stop misleading people like that. Get rid of the skull. In fact, I rather think Moses might have ground up the skull and fed it to the monks. I endured an entire Church of England training weekend in Aylesford, as it happens, being encouraged to consider the possible value of including icons, ancient paintings of Jesus, in my personal and our corporate religious practice. But I'm not going to do it. It's golden calf territory. What are the smaller things that we quite like the idea of? Is it lighting a candle while we pray? Prominent crucifixes around your church building? What about needing to do our quiet time in a special place? We must beware of trying to approach God through visual representations or through any created means like that. God is utterly distinct from creation and speaks into it. We have to receive what his word says and not create our own means of approaching him. God is adamantly opposed to being linked to holy objects or holy places. Perhaps even more dangerous for us than metal images is the possibility of creating mental images of God and worshipping those. I've probably said it myself. I like to think of God as dot, dot, dot. The God I believe in would never dot, dot, dot. For me, God is dot, dot, dot. It doesn't matter what I think. What matters is what God has said about himself. And look at where this kind of idolatry leads us. Apparently harmless tweaks to their religious practice, because it's helpful, leads to horrendous immorality. In verse 6, the people bring offerings and then sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. In verse 17, they're shouting. In verse 18, they're singing. In verse 19, they're dancing. And those translations are a bit polite. They can convey a sense of frenzied orgy. And that is the way it works. Get the truth about God wrong, and it leads to gross immorality down the line. Once we start to say, I like to think of God as, we'll increasingly find that our invented God approves of me doing just the immoral things that we wanted to do anyway. God hates this sin. In verse 10, he says that his wrath burns hot against the Israelites. In verses 25 to 29, God commands the tribe of Levi to carry out capital punishment amongst the Israelites. Perhaps it's on those who are most active in the rebellion. And later in verse 35, there's then a plague on those remaining. Now, even in the midst of those punishments, there is grace. All the Israelites deserved to die, but not all did. And don't forget that the Israelites are only alive because every day God keeps miraculously feeding them manna from heaven, And presumably he keeps on giving them that grace even while he's judging them. But these are nonetheless terrible punishments, and they point us to the very great seriousness of sin. How can a holy God dwell with people like this? How can he dwell with us when we have just the same deep-seated bias towards rebellion as they have? Well, just a very brief hint of the solution this evening, and a bit more you'll be pleased to hear next week. The solution is the work of mediation. The partial, temporary, slightly cliffhangerish solution is the work of Moses as a mediator between Yahweh and his people. Aaron tries to distance himself as far as possible from the sin of Israel. And in verse 22, he blames the people. You know the people, he says to Moses. They're set on evil. In verse 24, rather hilariously, he blames the fire. He says, the people gave me their gold and I threw it into the fire and out came this calf. It rather reminds me of a video I saw on Facebook of a mother with her son. She's filming her perhaps three-year-old son. And you can see the wall of her bedroom, which is covered in felt pen drawings. And the camera pans to her son, and he's standing there with the felt pen in his hand. And she says, who drew on my wall, Eric? And Eric says, Batman. It's not Batman, is it, Eric? It was you. It wasn't the fire, was it, Aaron? It was you. Aaron distances himself as far as possible from the people's sin. But by contrast, Moses identifies himself as closely as possible with the sin that he didn't commit. Indeed, he wonders, he asks, if perhaps he can somehow swap places with the guilty people. Look at verse 30 with me. The next day, Moses said to the people, "You have sinned a great sin, and now I'll go up to the Lord. Perhaps I can make atonement for your sin." So Moses returned to the Lord and said, "Alas, this people has sinned a great sin. They've made themselves gods of gold. But now if you'll forgive their sin, but if not, please blot me out of your book that you have written." But the Lord said to Moses, "Whoever sinned against me, I will blot out of my book. But now go, lead the people to the place about which I've spoken to you. Behold, my angel shall go before you." Moses mediates for the people. We'll see more of this next week. But he pleads with God to forgive the people. And God kind of partially relents. He won't wipe them out right now, although he reserves the right to do so. His plan to get his people to the promised land is going to continue. But you feel like the problem of sin has not really been satisfactorily dealt with. It's just hinted at. It's something to do with the work of mediation. But you see, the point is that Moses is not the perfect mediator. He may not have committed this particular sin, but he has committed other sins. And so if he swaps places with the people, they're still going to face the punishment that he deserves. And God will still have to judge them. Moses can't be a perfect mediator for them in that way because he's not sinless, but Jesus is. Jesus is our perfect mediator. He never committed any sin. And so when he offers to swap places with us, as Moses does, God accepts. He is punished for my sin, and I am given his perfection. And now that I'm perfect, God truly can dwell with me, and I don't need to fear his presence. How do you feel about the idea of God dwelling with you? We must not be casual about it. Amongst other sins, we've all misrepresented him one way or another, tried to approach him in ways that he has not approved. Sin makes it impossible for a holy God to dwell with us. But if we'll trust in the perfect work of mediation that Jesus carries out on our behalf, then we don't need to be uncomfortable with the idea either. Jesus said, "If anyone loves me, he will keep my word," not perfectly, but we'll keep trying. "And my Father will love him, and we will come to him and make our home with him." Tomorrow at school, at work, at home, let's remember the huge comfort and encouragement and honour of having God himself dwelling with us.